The headlines. Iran condemns U.S. sanctions on four Iranian nationals, saying the Biden administration is pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. Hamas says protests on the Gaza Strip will continue until Israel lifts the siege of the territory. Israeli forces have killed three Palestinian protesters since last weekend. Funeral procession is held in the holy Iraqi city of Karbala for senior Shia cleric Ayatollah Sayyid al-Hakim, who passed away on Friday. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Tehran has lashed out at Washington for imposing sanctions on four Iranian nationals. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh said the current U.S. administration is, unfortunately, pursuing the failed policy of its predecessor. He said U.S. officials are resorting to, quote, Hollywood-style scenarios to maintain their sanctions-driven existence. His remarks came after Washington blacklisted four Iranian intelligence operatives for an alleged kidnapping conspiracy on U.S. soil. The U.S. Treasury Department said that the sanctions target all property of the four individuals in the U.S. or in U.S. control and prohibits all transactions with them. They were alleged to be hatching a plot to abduct an anti-Tehran figure in July. The Iranian and Chinese foreign ministers have slammed U.S. unilateralism. In a phone call, the top diplomats also denounced Washington's interference in other countries' affairs. We discuss the issue in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
Iran's foreign minister says U.S. unilateralism is a threat to global peace and stability. During a phone conversation with his Chinese counterpart, Hossein Amir Abdollahian reiterated Iran's opposition to world powers' interference in other countries. The Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, also stressed the international community has no option but to fight unilateralism and bullying. Both sides agree that the U.S. is to blame for the current chaotic situation in Afghanistan. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Frank Emspach, Emeritus Professor from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Lawrence Davidson, former lecturer from Westchester University, joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Professor Emspach, we'll start with you. Pleasure to have you back. Your initial thoughts on this?
Well, I mean, that's been the Iranian and Chinese position for some time. Obviously, the United States has been the dominant foreign power in Afghanistan for about 20 years. But the question is, having said that, what to do? How does one deal with what they perceive as American fundamentalism? What precise steps is it going to be possible to take to both change perhaps the way the United States is operating, but also to find some ways to reach an agreement?
Thank you. And Lawrence Davidson, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Larry, your initial thoughts on this. Regardless if the U.S. has, and it's even questionable and arguable at times, the proper will going into some of these countries, it cannot really oftentimes export the kind of democracy or the kind of government it thinks will work in that country. It's often, I mean, as of the last couple decades, it's failed almost in every single try.
Right. I don't think that... the idea that the United States is trying to export democracy is anything other than a rationale used for American citizens. I mean, essentially, any government that will play along with or follow the American line, whatever that might be, probably is deemed worthy of support. In terms of looking for a vehicle that might be able to rein in the Americans as well as others who might try it, this sort of thing. I know this is going to be naive, but I've always been very supportive of the notion of international law and, the rule of law. And of course, the Americans after World War II were really important in terms of creating certain documents that support international law. And I think, well, at least as a talking point against the behavior of American unilateralism, which is really sort of the other side of the coin of exceptionalism, Americans' concept of exceptionalism, at least as a talking point, we ought to push the notion of international law.
Good stuff, Professor Davidson. And Professor Amspach, we saw Joe Biden say he got up there at the lectern right after the last soldiers basically evacuated Afghanistan last week, and he said that the U.S. is going to turn a page now, that the era of military interventionism and trying to rebuild countries is over. The U.S. has to basically spend its energy and resources now on confronting the threats posed from China and Russia, that the U.S. is not going to put the time and resources and the manpower at risk to try to rebuild countries and get involved everywhere where it feels it was getting involved in the last 60, 70 years. Do you buy it?
Well, I don't think it's quite that way. First of all, I think within the national security organizations in this country and the elite, there's a debate going on as to what to do. That's one thing. And that, because of that same speech or the speech the day before, he said, we will find the terrorists, we'll go after them wherever they are. It doesn't make any difference, making a claim of sovereignty of the United States over everybody. At the same time, he says, well, the way we're going to do this is maybe not send in armies and try to change the society. So I think that they're not quite sure what to do. And there's tremendous opposition here towards, obviously, sending American troops someplace else. But there's also this sense of, revenge, Lone Ranger business. And so his rhetoric on the terrorists was to undercut the attacks on him by the Republicans saying that he's botched this whole thing. But I don't think they have a clear notion of what to do. But I do think they're worried about this. They're worried about the overall economic hegemony of the United States. They're clearly worried that the system is changing in the world because of the strengths of China and others.
Interesting stuff. And Larry, final word with you, please. Go ahead.
No, I agree entirely. I think we ought to watch this debate. And I think also we ought to take into consideration other points of view. I mean, there's many other people in this country who have different ideas about foreign policy, whose ideas will never really reach the official level. I think we have to try to consider some of their ideas. But I agree. It's really up for grabs at the moment. And they'll try to figure something out before the 2022 by-elections. And that'll be telling as well.
All right, gentlemen, stay safe, both of you, and thank you both for joining us on the program. Frank Amspach joining us from Madison, Wisconsin, and Lawrence Davidson there joining us from Westchester, Pennsylvania. That's a wrap for this segment of your news review program. Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Welcome back. The Palestine resistance movement Hamas says the protests in the Gaza Strip will continue until Israel lifts a siege of the Palestinian territory. Hamas spokesman Abdel Latif Al-Kanu said the Palestinian nation wants the blockade on Gaza to be fully removed and will not accept gradual measures in this regard. He said the Palestinians have unlimited options to put pressure on Israel to end the blockade. His remarks came after another violent night of clashes between anti-siege protesters and Israeli troops. 3 people have been killed and dozens of others wounded since anti-Israel protests began last weekend. The territory has been under a tight Israeli air and sea blockade since 2007. The Russian military says Syrian air defenses had intercepted most of the missiles Israel fired toward Damascus on Friday. 21 out of the 24 rockets fired by Israeli warplanes using the Lebanese airspace were said to be destroyed midair before reaching their targets. Damascus issued another call to the UN to condemn the Israeli regime's attacks. The Syrian Foreign Ministry made the call in letters addressed to the UN Secretary General and the President of the Security Council. It also urged the international bodies to discharge their responsibilities to hold Israel accountable and prevent the repetition of such attacks. Israel regularly targets positions inside Syria, especially those of the resistance forces who have played a key role in fighting foreign-backed terrorism. A funeral procession has been held for senior Iraqi Shia cleric Grand Ayatollah Sayyid Mohammad Sayyid al-Hakim. Mourners converged on the Iraqi holy city of Karbala on Saturday to bid farewell to the eminent religious figure. Meanwhile, condolences are pouring in over the passing of Ayatollah al-Hakim. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian expressed deep sorrow, describing his demise as a great loss. Several Iraqi officials, including President Barham Saleh and the Secretary General of Parliament Serwan Abdullah, also sent condolence messages. The Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah also called Ayatollah Hakim's demise a major loss for the world of Islam. The top cleric passed away at the age of 87. He was among four prominent religious figures in Iraq and taught at the religious seminary of Najaf, alongside top cleric Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. Sayyid Hosseini, the director of the Islamic Center for Africa, says the late Ayatollah made great efforts to spread the message of Islam.
What now the people of Iraq is doing in participating in the funeral of late Ayatollah Muhammad Said Hakim is just to appreciate his long effort into spreading the message of Ahlul Bayt, fighting against the Saddam's regime and all of the cultural services that he has offered to the Muslim communities, to the Shia communities, to the global Ahlul Bayt followers. Well, to talk about the great personality of Ayatollah Muhammad Said Hakim, we need a lot of time, but in very short, he is the grandson of the late Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Hakim, which was one of the greatest maraja of all time in Iraq. And he is the student of Ayatollah Mohsen Hakim and also later on student of Ayatollah Khoui. He is actually up to this moment, he doesn't have an Iraqi passport. Having an Iranian passport, staying in Hawza in Najaf, ruling into the heart of a lot of people across the globe, and also you know, the government of Iraq is following his instruction.
Bahraini protesters have staged a rally against the kingdom's normalization of ties with Israel and the exchange of envoys between Manama and Tel Aviv. The protesters took to the streets of the capital Manama on Friday night. They chanted slogans against the normalization deal and expressed their support for Palestine and the resistance movement. The protest came after Israel appointed its first ambassador to Bahrain on Thursday. Similar protests were also held on Wednesday, after Bahrain sent an ambassador to Tel Aviv. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas condemned the move, saying that it represents Bahrain's support for Israeli policies against the Palestinians. Bahrain was one of the four Arab states that normalized relations with the Israeli regime under a deal brokered by the U.S. last year. Clashes have been ongoing between the Taliban and forces loyal to local leader Ahmad Massoud in Afghanistan's Panjshir province, with both sides claiming to have inflicted casualties on each other. Anti-Taliban fighters in Panjshir say that they have pushed back attacks and injured hundreds of Taliban forces. Massoud supporters say that the Taliban launched attacks from four different directions but have been unable to reach the valley. That is while the Taliban deny casualties on their side. The group says it has advanced well into Panjshir and unofficially claims to have fully taken the valley after defeating resistance forces there. Celebratory gunfires were heard across the capital, Kabul, after Taliban sources say that they have seized Panjshir. The valley has been the only territory in Afghanistan that has put up resistance against the Taliban after the group's takeover of the country in mid-August. The group swept through Afghanistan days after the U.S. announced that it was withdrawing from the country after two decades. All American troops and the forces of their allies have already evacuated the country. European Union governments have drawn criticism from lawmakers and campaign groups over their response to the crisis in Afghanistan. It comes after EU foreign affairs ministers agreed to set up a regional political platform to cooperate with Afghanistan's neighboring countries. Critics say the decision aims to shift the burden of Afghan refugees to others. Jerome Hughes has more.
As they stood for a photograph ahead of their latest meeting on Friday, EU foreign affairs ministers appeared to be in a jovial mood. However, critics say they have little to laugh about given the West's role in the Afghan crisis. At a press conference following the meeting, it was made clear the EU is not encouraging Afghan refugees to travel to the 27-country bloc.
The own commitments of the Taliban to let people to go out if they want. But it doesn't mean that we have any kind of commitment from the member states to take care of them.
That statement is likely to enrage rights groups and aid agencies. Oxfam had already published a statement accusing the EU of turning its back on Afghan refugees. European Commission data suggests 3.5 million people are currently internally displaced within the country. One in three are going hungry. 500,000 people are currently trying to leave Afghanistan, according to the Commission. EU lawmakers say it's not fair for the EU to place the responsibility of refugees on neighbouring countries like Pakistan and Iran.
Make sure that they have and they will own their migration crisis and that we stay away from that as best we can. I think that is hypocritical at best.
A coordinated strategy by the EU to the refugee crisis is urgently required, experts argue.
If the European Union was able to react to respond to the refugee challenge collectively, the individual burden for every single country would be much lower.
The role the EU, NATO, Britain and the US played in Afghanistan has been castigated in the European Parliament.
The Americans lied to their people. The Americans spent over $2.2 trillion and over $2 trillion of it went to private contractors.
One legislator suggests the EU misjudged the level of support that exists for the Taliban.
They obviously were appealing for many in Afghanistan because otherwise they hadn't taken over the country so quickly.
Without assistance from the international community, European Commission officials forecast medical supplies will run out in Kabul within 2 weeks and 120 children in the country could die every single day. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Why is the uprising of Ashura different from all the uprisings and movements of the world? January 16, 1994. Imam Hussein says, I did not rise up out of self-interest or for the sake of seeking pleasure. The more selfless one is, the more value does he gain in what he does. The more one moves away from the peak of selflessness, the closer they get to the peak of selfishness. This applies to what is tangible. But when it comes to spirituality, these equations are far more discerning. We do not understand it because of our materialistic and ordinary vision. Nonetheless, men of vision understand and perceive it. The critic in this matter, the goldsmith and the jeweler, is God the Almighty. And for sure, the critic sees well. If there is an ounce of impurity in our work, its value would diminish accordingly, and God would reduce its lasting effect. God, the Exalted, is an insightful critic. The work of Imam Hussein is a work in which there is not even a slight hint of impurity. Hence, you see this quality achievement has lasted to this day and will last forever.
Ana mazlum Hussein, Ana mazlum Hussein, Ana mazlum Hussein, Ana mazlum Hussein, Ana latshan.
Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, made the army of reason overcome the army of ignorance.
Ana latshan, ana
latshan. Who could believe that after these people were killed in that desert, far from their homes, while their bodies were buried there, with so much propaganda spread against them, all killed in such a heartless manner, their hometown of Medina put on fire even after their martyrdom? This rose garden was devastated and the petal of roses were all thrusted. Yet later, anyone who would feel the aroma of the rose water from his garden, according to which rule of nature, a petal of that rose garden can last so long in the nature. However, you view, the more time passes by, the more the aroma of that rose garden spreads. There are some people who do not believe that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is the grandfather of Imam Hussein and that he follows in his path. Yet, they believe in Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. Some do not believe in his father, Ali, alayhi salam. Yet, they believe in Imam Hussein, alayhi salam. They do not believe in God, the God Imam Hussein worshipped. Yet, before Imam Hussein, they are humble and respectful. This is the outgrowth of Imam Hussein's purity.
You've done. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Over the past decade, countries in the African continent have experienced an economic boom, but the benefits have not trickled down to the common people, and grinding poverty is still prevalent in many countries. So who benefits from Africa's poverty? A leading Pan-Africanist has the answer. Let's listen in.
The reality is the poverty of Africa is the glory of some civilizations. Poverty is an industry. Ignorance is an industry, big industry.
Hello and a warm welcome to yet another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place in Africa. Now, this week we are focusing on some of the roots of poverty in Africa, which has been exacerbated by the COVID-19 pandemic. In the second segment of our program, we shall head deep into Cameroon's rainforest that's facing danger from European Union companies that are on rampage, destroying this amazingly diverse ecosystem in their pursuit of profits.
The West and Africa's poverty. Over the last 20 years, Africa recorded strongest growth decade on record. In that period, the African narrative has swung from the hopeless continent to Africa rising. However, the experience of major African economies shows that the benefits of growth at the top are not trickling down to the poor. So where are the profits going? Well, some of the top 100 companies in all of Africa are mostly linked to former European colonial powers and the United States. The exploitation of Africa by neo-colonial powers continues unabated while the masses are sinking deeper into poverty.
Professor Howard Nicholas says Western countries want to ensure that Africa stays poor for the sake of survival of the developed world. Let's take a listen.
Africa historically, Sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. Okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow Sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep Sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone else. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is.
Now, to discuss some of the reasons for the continued poverty in Africa, despite positive growth in most countries over the last several years, we have contacted Joseph Ocheno, a leading commentator on African affairs. Thank you very much, Mr. Ocheno, for your time. Now, rising poverty levels stand in sharp contrast to the large natural resource wealth and overwhelming young labor force of many African countries. What's really happening?
Because of all the complexities of the continent in the last 50 years, where somehow I don't think many of the leaders have got it right, it has meant that insufficient investment has gone into education, insufficient investment has gone into preparing the natural skill force of all the various countries on the African continent. I think nearly every country in the continent you can talk about. So for that reason, while we have a huge amount of resources, the labor force has been scanty, and the level of skills has been relatively low. And yet at the same time, partly because of the performance of the various African economies, some of the better performing African skills from the African continent have tended to find their ways mainly in the West.
While the era of colonialism in Africa is long gone, it's no secret that its effects are still being felt across the continent. In the wake of the recent economic growth in Africa, leading Western multinational corporations appear to be in a rush to grab the largest share of Africa's untapped resources. Pan-Africanist PLO Lumumba gives an example of the ongoing neo-colonial project to grab Africa's resources.
The neocolonial project requires that Africa must remain within the sphere of influence of these states. Today, if you look at the United Kingdom, which has left Europe, one would have thought that those are their cousins and that they should sit in comfort with them. You now see their involvement being de-emphasized in Europe and their interest and appetite growing towards the Commonwealth. Because in the Commonwealth, they are the major domos. They'll tell us what to do. In Europe, they have to grapple with the Germans and the French, and they don't like it. That is the unspoken bit of it. The French also are in Europe, but the Germans are too strong, and they don't like it. So they want to hold Côte d'Ivoire, Gabon, and tell them what to do.
Now, Mr. Ocheno, apart from the factor you earlier mentioned, we see that poverty remains in Africa while Western multinationals make abnormal profits. Are they continuing the colonial loot of African resources?
The challenges facing the African continent, as far as poverty is concerned, and indeed any other development issue, really is a matter that African governments and African leaders, and I suggest African peoples, particularly the young African population, should stand up, get counted, and commit themselves to change. I am delighted that in Zambia, the recent election that took place, a number of young people stood up. I know a number of people who were in the private sector who decided to get involved in the politics of the country, to simply say they want to be part of the change and they want to be able to influence the direction of the country. So in this continent, poverty is rarely a question of political debate and discourse. It's rarely a serious matter when it comes to academic discourse.
Well, according to our 2020 UNDP report, every year an estimated $88.6 billion, equivalent to 3.7% of Africa's GDP, leaves the continent as illicit capital flight. Now, Amina Mohammed, the Deputy Secretary General of the United Nations, explains here on how these illicit financial flows affect Africa.
These staggering losses would be enough to fill 75% of the continent's health financing gap. They would more than be what is needed to achieve the Sustainable Development Goal on Inclusive Education, SDG 4, and they are one-third of what Africa needs annually to fund infrastructure projects, foundation on which we would build our prosperity. These flows pose a threat to stability and security in African countries. They're undermining our institutions and democracy, and they jeopardize sustainable development and the rule of law.
Western multinationals are engaged in illicit financial flows and tax evasion in Africa, thus leaving many governments broke and unable to fund their budgets. What should be done to compel multinationals take responsibility and pay taxes to stop this massive loss by African countries?
I think the answer lies in very many facets. One, it lies with the African peoples, particularly the younger population of the African continent. The youth of Africa need to take a position, rise up, and begin to question their governments, number one. Number two, African governments, while they're being held to account, they need to begin to act slightly more on behalf of the citizens of Africa rather than on behalf of these multinationals. But number three, I think thanks to news media like yourselves, increasing campaigns means that it is possible now for some of the issues of exploitation of the African continent and resources to be addressed. I really look forward to a robust judiciary on the continent, where perhaps citizens take their governments to court, citizens take these multinationals to the domestic courts, and that the domestic courts have got the confidence, the judiciary have got the confidence to take these guys to task.
The IMF and the World Bank are viewed by many Africans as institutions which are instruments in the hands of great industrial powers of the world to subjugate African countries in favor of their domestic prosperity.
Femi Falana, a Nigerian human rights lawyer and activist, recently slammed African countries for implementing neoliberal policies.
We must take more than a passing interest in the socioeconomic crisis in our country and the African continent. You have a situation where our governments are implementing neoliberal policy, dangerous policies, retrench workers, devalue your currency, withdraw subsidies from health, education, and the rest of them. And so how do you cope? You are multiplying and you are promoting poverty. And I'm talking of IMF and World Bank.
Now, Mr. Ocheno, how are World Bank and IMF austerity measures contributing to the poverty in Africa through loans which come with strict conditions that have affected major social sectors?
I can say that amongst many things in Uganda, and I can actually take you to Zambia, I can take you to many, many African countries, and that's really, really bound like that in the same. It's really been a shameful thing, the manner in which the IMF and the World Bank conducted themselves. But if I may say so briefly, once upon a time I was in London, and I met a senior African diplomat who told me that he was part of a delegation with his president to the IMF and World Bank, and he met a Western minister who was instructing them to behave like a certain African president who was saying yes, yes to them, and unless they did that, they were not going to get IMF World Bank loans. What does it mean? It basically means that behave like these guys, you know, retrench, you know, cut down government, and give us access to exploitation.
African dictators, politicians, and corrupt bureaucrats stash their illicit wealth in Western countries. An investigative journalist from the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists gives an insight here on how Africa's richest woman, Isabel dos Santos, looted her country's wealth assisted by American and European agents and financial institutions.
A whole swathe of service providers, the bankers, the lawyers, the oil companies, the consultants, have allowed the extraction of the resources that belong to the Angolan people from their country into Western capitals where this money gets reinvested.
Now, how have Western financial institutions contributed to the looting of Africa by dictators and multinationals?
Oh, it has been various by the many facets that I suggested. But I think the most common one for Western financial institutions is basically to be the conduits for loots. Western banks particularly routinely accept and store and help to snatch off billions of dollars from Africa. You have cases of former Nigerian president who, you know, kept away perhaps, was it almost close to $5 billion, if I'm not wrong. So those cases where African leaders keep monies, usually looted money, on you know, in Western financial institutions, with the collusion of these banks and financial institutions.
Thanks, Mr. Ocheno, for your analysis, and it's always great having you. Now, let's take a short break, and when we come back, we shall focus on the ongoing destruction of Cameroon's pristine rainforests by European Union companies. Stay with us.
EU destroying Cameroon's rainforest for rubber.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
Cameroonian activists recently gathered in front of the headquarters of the European Union delegation in the country's capital, Yaoundé, to demand the end of the EU support for rubber originating from rainforest destruction.
The rally was held on the occasion of the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples after 10,000 hectares of rainforest in the south of Cameroon, an area of about the size of Paris, were destroyed by the French multinational rubber company Halcyon Agri. indigenous people have been greatly affected by this destruction of the rainforest. An inhabitant of the forest speaks on deforestation.
La forêt est tellement importante pour nous. Alors quand quelqu'un vient donc toucher à ça, ça nous fait mal au cœur. Ça nous fait tellement mal au cœur. Parce que si nous voyons ce que les sociétés forestières ont fait dans les IFA, là où les engins passent, ils dévastent la forêt. Toutes les plantes et médecines qui sont là, ils déterrent ça, ils tuent ça. Et ça crée problème.
For more on the dangers facing Cameroon's rainforest, we have contacted Samuel Nguifo, an award-winning Cameroonian lawyer. He's the founder of the Center for Environmental Development. Thanks a lot for your time, Sam. Now, the European Union claims to be at the forefront of environmental conservation, yet companies from member states are destroying Cameroon's rainforest. This is clearly a case of double standards. Now, what's your take?
If I look at what is going on in not only in Cameroon, but in the rest of the Congo Basin countries in Central Africa, yes, there is a lot of logging activities going on. There is a lot of forest destruction going on involving companies of totally diverse nature, either logging companies or mining companies, companies involved in agro-industries, large construction companies. So this is a very clear trend that destruction is happening, and we see the forest clearly disappearing. We are very much concerned by what we see. And what we also hear is the speeches, the discourse in Europe and in the rest of the world. Everybody claims to be protecting the environment. But what some companies do is totally contrary to what their states are saying. And this is a trend also that we see, we have been witnessing in the past 30 years.
The government of Cameroon has been criticized for failing to take action to protect the country's rainforest. The masses feel they have been abandoned by the government and are now at the mercy of foreign companies destroying the rainforest.
Cameroon still has 40% of its indigenous forest. The government grants licenses for logging in alignment with their forestry policy. Despite this, illegal logging and land grabbing is a constant battle for the community. No major Baka Pygmy community have a naturally strong commitment to protect their forest.
Why is the Cameroonian government failing to take tangible action to stop these European multinationals from destroying the country's rainforest?
I think that one of the most destructive actions against the forest, besides logging, was putting in the mind of the decision makers in Africa that they can't do it. They can't achieve development without logging. They have forest on their land. They were very lucky to receive this from nature, and they have to log. They have to grant logging rights. And a forest is supposed to be cut and provide income to the state. I think this is a major mistake. It's an assumption that is totally false. But our policies in Central Africa are all built on this assumption. Nobody thinks the forest can generate income without being logged.
It's estimated that nearly 40% of Cameroon is forested. However, the country is rapidly losing this critical natural resource. According to estimates, more than 3 million hectares of Cameroon's forests have been cleared since 1990, an area approximately the size of Belgium.
Now, Mr. Samuel, what is the general state of the rainforest in Cameroon?
We do not have like a yearly or a periodical assessment of what we have in the forest. So it's very difficult to have scientific grounds to really say what is going on. What we see from our visits on the field is that the forest is very clearly disappearing. A major part of the wildlife is also disappearing, And one of the reasons is that logging has open access to the forest to many people, including poachers, who were able to go as far as possible to have access to wildlife habitats and log in a very huge quantity. So these are the side effects of logging.
Now, a very grim outlook there on Cameroon's rainforest, which needs collective action for its protection. The future of our planet is Africa, because the continent's people, biodiversity, and habitats are crucial for genetic diversity in face of climate change.
In a bid to meet the ever-growing demand of forest products and resources at international level, such as wood, palm oil, rubber, and other elements harnessed by industrial logging and extensive agriculture, this will only further deplete Africa's biggest carbon sink. What should be done to stop the destruction of the rainforest in Cameroon that is part of the Congo Basin rainforest area that absorbs carbon dioxide that would otherwise be released into the atmosphere?
I think the very first thing that we should do will be to have a meeting bringing together all the stakeholders to assess what has been done in forest management so far, and to learn the lessons that we can get from what we did in the past 20 years, 25 years, and from there to take decisions. Illegal logging is going on, legal logging is not sustainable, the forest is disappearing, and yet nobody says, let's stop and look behind us to see how we were able to perform. And then from there, let's plan the future. This would be done by any person with a little sense of logic to assess what he did. In fact, every single person at the end of the year assesses what happened in his life in the previous year. And on the grounds of the lessons learned, plans the future, right? Why don't we do it as a state, as a region, the Congo Basin? Why don't we do it for such an important resources that we were so blessed to have on our land?
In an effort to preserve the Cameroon rainforest, it's essential to have political will from the government to stop the greed by European multinationals which do not care about the environment. A local here feels corruption by the authorities is a major factor.
Now, are you optimistic that governments and international community will take action to save and preserve Cameroon's rainforest and indeed Africa's rainforest?
I think if we don't act very fast and if we don't act with very clear actions, efficient enough to change the trend that we are seeing, I think it will be too late very soon. I think the window that we have to act is probably closing very, very soon. So what we need to do today is an action on both, at both ends. We need to act in the consumer countries so that people understand that what they do by buying timber, by consuming timber products, if they are not careful enough, what they do is that they are contributing to the exacerbation of climate change. And we need to act at the producers' end by making sure that the states understand that the forest is on their land, but that they are part of humanity. And as such, they are obliged to think about not only their country or their communities, but also humanity.
Well, clearly, action has to be taken now to save Cameroon's rainforest, or it will be too late and the whole world will suffer the consequences. Well, that's all the time we had for this edition of Africa Today. Do drop us a line through our social media handle and let us know what you think about today's program. God bless you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering a doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum rahmatullahi wa barakatuhu, dear listeners. This is your host Musa al-Bahadiri, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you as usual from IRIB English Radio. Joining us in the studio is our dear friend, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, who is an Islamic researcher at the Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, assalamu alaikum rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Today's question is about laughing on the day of Ashura. We know that the Ashura is the culmination of a 10-day mourning period wherein we, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt, the household of the Prophet, all of our sorrows and tears compound on this very special and sorrowful day. As such, the question is as follows. Is laughing forbidden on the day of Ashura, and does laughing make us a part of the ones whom are cursed in the ziyarah of Ashura, as it is seemingly indicated in this part of the ziyarah when we recite, وَهَذَا يَوْمٌ فَرْحَتْ بِهِ آلُ زِيَادٍ وَآلُ مَرْوَانٍ بِقَتْلِهِمُ الْحُسَيْنِ صَلَوَاتُ اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ. Meaning, and this is a day wherein the kin of Ziyad and the kin of Marwan rejoiced at their killing of Al-Husayn, Allah's peace be upon him.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So, it's a question related, first of all, to jurisprudence. People need to follow, refer to their maraji taqlid, the authorities that they follow. But usually the answer is that, in and of itself, laughing is not, a haram act. It's not forbidden. But people are highly recommended to be sad during at least the 10th of Muharram, the day of Ashura. But it's not haram, it's not forbidden, unless it is counted as a kind of disrespect to the, Imam Hussein alayhi salam and the Ahlul Bayt.
A celebration, for example.
Pardon?
A celebration, for
example. Yeah, a celebration and maybe, a wedding ceremony in which, people are playing all kinds of music, they're dancing and they're laughing. In that case, normally people consider it as a kind of disrespect to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So laughing in and of itself is not haram. People are encouraged to be away from that, of course. But if it is counted as a kind of disrespect to the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, so from that aspect it is forbidden. But I mean, usually people on the day of Ashura, they are not holding, wedding ceremonies or so on and so forth. They, I mean, may happen to them to laugh or, a few times. It's okay, but it's not haram, religiously speaking. But as I mentioned, morally speaking, we are highly recommended to be sad, at least during the 10th of Muharram. And as you rightly mentioned, this is the culmination of all the afflictions which befell on Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions. Now, I would like to share a narration from Imam Ali alayhi salam, which is a very interesting narration for the followers of the Ahlul Bayt. Imam Ali alayhi salam says that, إن الله تبارك وتعالى اتلع إلى الأرض فاختارنا واختار لنا شيعة ينصروننا. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala chose us, that is the Ahlul Bayt, from the people on the earth, and then He chose some Shia for us, some lovers, some supporters. And then Imam Ali alayhi salam talks about the features of these Shia, yansurunana, they help us, وَيَفْرَحُونَ لِفَرَحِنَا, they rejoice for our happiness, so when we are happy, they are also happy, and that is one of the reasons that we see that as Shia, and not only the Shia, many Sunnis, they celebrate in the auspicious days which are related to great personalities like the Prophet, Imam Ali alayhi salam, Fatima al-Zahra, and all the the other Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. Right. So we know that Imam of the time, Imam Zaman, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is happy on the Day of Ghadir, for example, which is the anniversary of the Day of Ghadir, in which Imam Ali alayhi salam was appointed as the immediate successor of the Prophet. So one of the narrations which confirm this act is the one that talk about the fact that يَفْرَحُونَ لِفَرَحَنَا, when we are happy, the Shia are also happy. وَيَحْزَنُونَ لِحُزْنَنَا, when we are sad, they are also sad. So for sure, Imam Zaman, may Allah hasten his reappearance, is sad on the day of Ashura, or at least during the 10 days of Muharram, or maybe the whole month of Muharram and Safar. We should not think that it has happened 14 centuries ago and now Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will not remember that day, because we have some narrations, for example, about Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam or Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam, that as soon as the month of Muharram arrived, we did not see these two Imams, for example, laughing anymore. They were sad all the times, and when it was the day of Ashura, it was the culmination of their sadness. So for sure, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his reappearance, is sad through these days. He's weeping for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. We have some ziyarat referring to this fact, like the ziyarat known as ziyarat Nahiya Muqaddasa. So the conclusion is that, as I mentioned, it is highly recommended for the people to, show their sadness during the 10 days of Muharram, at least, and more importantly, on the day of Ashura. This is a seerah of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, and we need to follow them from this aspect. But as I mentioned, it may happen even for people taking part in the mourning ceremonies that they may laugh once, twice, so it's okay. I mean, no one is calling that a kind of disrespect.
Right.
But, I mean, the whole day they are showing that they are sad by wearing, for example, from in different cultures, wearing black, beating on their chest in a normal way. Through different
expressions of sorrow and sadness.
They express their sadness. And the next point is that